Right, here we go again. Welcome everybody to Didactic Mind, episode 8, The Lies of Libertarianism, where I discuss libertarianism and its attractions and its utter failures, which is a subject I've been wanting to address for some time now. So, very warm welcome as always to all of my devoted readers. I do have a fair few of them now, and they are some of the coolest people on the internet anywhere. Really, I mean, an amazing collection of minds that stops by my blog and leaves comments and is very appreciative of what I do. So big shout out to all of you guys who have subscribed to my blog, who read my work, who listen to this podcast every week. Too many of you to name, just to, you know, come up with a few. Adam Piggott and John C., who both have their own podcasts here on SoundCloud. Lieutenant Colonel Tom Kratman, Dire Badger, Man of the Atom, you know, Brian Niemeyer even has been known to stop by on occasion. And several others, you know, Pat himself, who very kindly helped me to understand how to use Audacity properly so that these podcasts actually sound a bit better, and hopefully will sound even more clean once I get a proper microphone for this stuff, and various others, Eduardo the Magnificent, you know, all the other commenters who have stayed, Capios, and others who have commented throughout the year. Big, big thanks to all of you, because this is the last podcast of 2019. The next podcast will be on New Year's Day. And as of right now, where I'm standing, we have less than 49 hours to go before the clock switches over, the calendar turns, and we are officially into the year 2020. The year in which I anticipate the crushing will reach truly biblical proportions. The year in which I believe that his most noble, illustrious, august, benevolent, and legendary celestial majesty, the God Emperor of mankind, Donaldus Triumphus Magnus Astra, the first of his name, will be re-elected. And I'm making that prediction, I'm calling it right now, re-elected in a true Trump slide, barring anything truly unforeseen, truly weird. I expect that we will be greeting the second inauguration of Donald Trump in 2021, and it will be beautiful. I am very much looking forward to the epic amounts of salt mining we're going to be doing then. But that is, excuse me, very far in the future, at least from where we're standing right now. If you are new to this podcast, as always, please hit the subscribe button. Make sure that you are always notified of new uploads, because there should be one pretty much every week, assuming I stay on a regular schedule, which I now plan to do. And this is kind of a catch-up podcast in many ways, because I've just been busy traveling for a while. So I will be doing this more regularly, hopefully with some more content that is requested directly by the users and by the readers, I should say. And we will look forward to hopefully another year of growth and exploration and more wisdom from the blog, which has, I think, probably had its best year, not in terms of page views, or maybe it has, I don't know, I'd have to check, but definitely in terms of reader engagement. I mean, I've never seen the blog this active in 7 years of writing. It has been very nearly 7 years that I've had this thing up, which is astonishing. But the fact that it's been up for 7 years indicates to you that if you look back over time, especially at my very earliest posts from the beginning of 2013, just how much I have changed and moved as an individual. And in terms of my views, my ideas, my beliefs, and so on. Things have definitely evolved in terms of my politics. One of the areas where my politics have really changed is, of course, with respect to my political philosophy or my political leanings about libertarianism. Now, if you look back to 2013, I proudly called myself a libertarian, quite happily. I mean, I was a libertarian. I believed in the libertarian ethos, the libertarian creed. I believed that libertarianism was a sensible, workable, good method of governance over people, over societies. The reason why this changed over time is because I began to understand the concept of nation. And the reality is that you cannot have a nation that is compatible with the core tenets of libertarian philosophy. Now, before anybody gets the wrong idea, let me make something very clear. I really like the core ideas behind libertarian thinking. I really like the idea of a society where basically everybody just leaves everyone else the hell alone. I really like that idea. Because for me, that's almost ideal. I don't like most people. And that's just a fact. I am a reader. I am a massive intellectual snob. That's a well-known fact about me. There are very, very few people, comparatively speaking, whom I genuinely respect as intellectual superiors to myself. Even though, I mean, I'm not, like, I'm smart, but I'm not ridiculously smart. I'm, you know, the last time I checked, and I don't believe this was a tested IQ test or anything like that, the last time I checked, my IQ is somewhere between 135 and 140, which isn't actually that impressive, by the way, because it number one, it depends on which scale you use, whether it's Stanford-Binet or Wechsler. But number two, there are readers on my blog, who make me look like a village idiot. I mean, seriously, they're so much smarter than me, it's not even funny. And there are people whose works I follow, whose intellectual exploits I follow, who make me look stupid on a regular basis. But the problem, the thing about libertarianism is it appeals to people like me, people who genuinely don't care for most people, aren't interested in dealing with most people, and really just have a strong desire for solitude and like our own company. Libertarianism is very appealing in this respect because to be a libertarian means essentially to be very much of the live and let live type. You don't really want to be bothered, and you don't want to bother anyone else. And that's not a bad way to live. It really isn't. That's not a bad way to do things at all. It's a wonderful idea. It's a wonderful philosophy, at least in theory. In practice, it's got huge problems, and it's totally unworkable. Now, people come to libertarianism in a variety of different ways. I mean, some libertarians come into being by reading the works of Ayn Rand. I read The Fountainhead when I was about 17, I think. Yeah, I believe it was summer break in grade 11. And I was, you know, on vacation for 2 months, so I was like, okay, I got a bunch of stuff to do, and I was quite disciplined about what I did. You know, I did a lot of maths homework, and studied a lot, and I also read a lot. And one of the books I ended up reading was The Fountainhead. But I didn't read Atlas Shrugged until almost 10 years later. It wasn't until about 2012, something like that, that I read Atlas Shrugged, And was it 10 years later or maybe more? I don't know, something like that. I can't remember. But it was about 2012 when I read Atlas Shrugged. And that was about the time period where I was like, yeah, libertarianism makes sense. I agree with this concept. This is a good idea. I never went full objectivist because, you know, you never go full objectivist. It's a very, very bad idea. If you go full objectivist, then you believe that everything can be reduced down to rational principles and, you know, that there are superior beings who are completely rational in every respect and all of their actions are guided by pure rationality for the greater good. And it's all complete nonsense. I mean, to be an objectivist requires you to essentially engage in everyday activities of life without any sense of joy or pleasure. I mean, food is to be eaten without pleasure. It's just to be consumed. It's there for nourishment, nothing else. It doesn't matter what you eat. It's just there to nourish your body. There's no aesthetic pleasure to be found in it. Sex is to be engaged in grimly and for the pursuit of higher objectives. To paraphrase Murray Rothbard, who is a very famous anarcho-capitalist and who was very critical of objectivism and Ayn Rand. Some people get into libertarianism because they see conservatism or the traditional right as being too authoritarian. They see these guys thumping their Bibles and saying, you know, waving their fingers and lecturing people about morality and saying, you know, premarital sex is bad, drug use is bad, too much alcohol is bad. If you do not behave properly, then God will punish you. He will visit his wrath upon you and you will suffer and burn in hell for all eternity and all that sort of thing. And that sits very poorly with a young person's mind because it is usually a young person that comes to libertarianism. That's the people who come to libertarianism just want to be left alone. They want to live as they see fit. They don't want too many rules. So they come to this creed of libertarianism, which essentially says first, don't ever initiate violence. You know, the non-aggression principle is the core foundational element of libertarianism. It says very simply, do not ever initiate aggression against someone. The moment someone commits aggression against you, then you are free to respond with proportional force. Which is, you know, to explain it very simply, if someone comes up to you and, you know, grabs your shoulder on the street when your back is turned to him, you don't then turn around and punch his lights out. If, however, somebody comes up to you and smacks you in the face, then you punch him. That's fair. But you don't stick a knife in his ribs. That's not fair, you know. These things are the core of the libertarian ethic. Do no harm. Do not harm people who have not harmed you first. Great idea. Love that idea. I'm very much in favor of it. Then you continue on through libertarian thought, and, you know, you start with... if you start with Ayn Rand, then you probably end up going in the wrong direction. But you start with people like, Ludwig von Mises, at least some of his shorter essays, of course. Milton Friedman, Free to Choose, that was a big influence on me at the time, which basically talked about how good it is to leave people to their own devices and to give people the freedom to choose how to live their lives. And that's a revolutionary idea and a wonderful one, especially in a culture that is state-run and state-owned. And it's very appealing, extremely appealing, to the American mind, which is all about freedom and individual liberty. These are good things. I'm not denying that for a moment. I love the idea of being free to choose your own life and your own path. That's a really great thing. I'm not putting that down in any way. But where we go very wrong is in essentially saying that this non-aggression principle and a few other sensible ideas are all you really need to run society. Because if you start with that idea of the non-aggression principle, and you start with the core ethos that, as Ludwig von Mises did, that all human behavior stems from basic axioms, and that all economic and social behavior can be observed and studied. Von Mises called it praxeology, the science of human behavior, of which his contention was economics was but a small field, a very fascinating field, but a small field nonetheless. Then you start with the principle of human action, which is to say, man acts. Man decides to improve his own station in life, because if he does not act, then he stays where he is, and this is observably not true. All throughout history, we have seen in our own daily lives, in the history and actions of our predecessors, our children, that given stimulus, man acts to change his situation. So from this basic principle is derived the whole beautiful structure and you know the foundations, the cornerstone, the groundwork, the superstructure, and you know eventually the masonry, the architecture, the sculptures, and the beautiful lattice work, and the amazing shingle work of the libertarian creed, or the libertarian philosophy, which essentially, if you carry it out to its logical conclusions, says that you don't need government to rule over you. If you let people alone and just let them choose for themselves what they want to do, spontaneous order will arise. And if you avoid all government intervention in markets, then people will simply choose for themselves what the best outcomes are. People will band together for common self-defense. People will create their own monetary standards and will adhere to them. And if somebody fails to live up to his obligations, his economic obligations, his contractual obligations, then a system without bailouts, without guarantees, will ensure that nobody ever gets too big, that if anybody ever tries to screw with the money supply or tries to monkey with contracts, he will pay the price in the form of economic failure. If somebody tries to monopolize a particular commodity, that won't be possible, because somebody else will always come along and find a better way to do things, and eventually the monopoly will get undercut. If people get sick, if people start dying, then somebody will come along and come up with cures and medicines to heal the sick, the lame, and the dying. This is, I repeat, a wonderful vision of society. I am not against such a society, if it can be found to work. Problem is, it doesn't work. And this is where you get libertarians all rushing in and saying, well, you know, this is ridiculous. Of course it's worked. We've had all of these historical examples in the Old West where micro-societies have formed and spontaneous order has arisen. We have these studies from prisons in World War II where prisoners of war created spontaneous order, both in, you know, Japanese internment camps and in Vietnamese POW camps. A spontaneous order arose. We had barter-based market exchange mechanisms that came up where cigarettes would be used as the currency of exchange, and that worked beautifully to allow people to, you know, make transactions, economic transactions with each other. They came up with a currency of their own, and so on and so forth. I mean, you can trigger libertarians really, really easily just by making a statement like that. They're even easier to trigger than communists are. I mean, with communists, you point out all of the horrors of communism and all the things that they've done wrong, and they'll always say, well, communism, real communism, hasn't tried, you know, that's not real communism, you know. 20 million killed in Russia. No, that's not real communism. Another 50 million killed in China. No, that's not real communism. It was never tried properly. Nobody ever tried to do it right before. It wasn't until the Black Book of Communism came out and was finally released that the true horrific death toll of communism was revealed. In a similar way, in fact, even more easily, you can trigger libertarians by pointing out that in libertarian societies, you essentially have to have everybody with a nosebleed IQ. And you have to have so many conditions in place to begin with that the entire thing becomes unworkable. They're like, no, of course that's not unworkable. Of course we can get it to work. We just need time to figure it out. I'm sure we've got smart enough people to make it work. Okay. The fastest way I've ever found to trigger a libertarian is simply by asking him, as Davis M.J. Orini did. Those of you who have been around the manosphere a long time may know the name. Davis Orini is a pretty prolific blogger and author. I don't know what happened to him. He's just kind of disappeared off the scene of late, but you know, for a while he was around. And he made a YouTube video some time ago in which, many years ago actually, in which he just said, who's going to build the roads? And that's a great way to trigger a libertarian. I know, because I was triggered by it. I remember writing a long email to my dad some years ago about how it would be possible to build a libertarian-style road system, complete with a very, very long technical explanation about how to build intelligent toll gates that measure, you know, how much you use a private road, and thereby paying as you go and assigning revenues, assigning revenues and charges as necessary, you know, via meters installed in cars and so on and so forth. It was pretty cringy looking back on it now. But you know, that's one of the problems with being a libertarian. You come up with all of these epicycles to try to explain your position. Now, I'm jumping ahead a bit, so let me backtrack and explain, I think, four core reasons why libertarianism doesn't work as advertised, or can't work as advertised, and then tie that into what is a more useful philosophy, which is essentially nationalism. And I will try to finish by essentially explaining where we go from here. So the first problem with libertarianism is its complete lack of moral foundation. Now, libertarianism basically says, okay, first, don't aggress against anyone. All right, well, that sounds like a good idea, except that there are times, and there will be times, when it is necessary to foster aggression against someone. It is written in the Torah, the Hebrew Bible, if someone comes to kill you, rise up and kill him first. That is a valid and necessary principle of self-defense. And the thing you have to understand about self-defense is that it's not really about defense. Self-defense is a very mild, whitewashed term. Self-defense really comes down to, I'm going to beat the shit out of you until you stop trying to hurt me. That's what it really is. I am going to break your bones and snap your tendons and, you know, inflict horrific bodily harm upon you until you stop trying to attack me. That's what it comes down to. And the same principle applies whether you're talking about an individual or you're talking about national armies. Now, the libertarian ethic essentially says that in a libertarian world, nobody would ever try to attack anyone else because everybody will live by this wonderful principle of non-aggression. Okay. What if you have an entity that comes along, a conquering nation or a conquering philosophy like Islam, which says, we're not going to allow you to stand. We're not going to allow you to live as you please. You have things we want. We're going to give you three choices. Either you convert to our way of life, or you live as essentially slaves, or you die. What's going to happen then? Now, the libertarian ideal is that everybody bands together for mutual self-defense. And, you know, individuals coming together will find a way to overwhelm a numerically and technologically superior foe. Okay, has that ever actually worked? Not really. The quintessential example that is always given is about how the American militia defeated the greatest military the world has ever seen, or had ever seen at that point, the British Empire. Sorry, but that is a myth. And while it is a very convenient myth, and it's a wonderful myth, it is still a myth. The British were not beaten by American militia. They were harassed and they were defeated repeatedly by British, by American militia. That is true. By farmers with pitchforks, as it was said. Here's the problem. General Cornwallis did not surrender to George Washington at Yorktown. He didn't. General Cornwallis actually surrendered. Well, he didn't surrender. His subordinate, General O'Hara, surrendered the sword of Cornwallis. But he didn't surrender because of Washington. He surrendered because the French had arrived and the French were bombarding his position. He didn't surrender to Washington. He surrendered to the French commander. Why is that? Because Cornwallis had almost no respect for the militia's capabilities. And because Washington's regulars were still relatively few in number and couldn't really defeat Cornwallis in open battle. The reason why America survived the War of Independence was indeed due to the tremendous courage and sacrifices of its men and its soldiers. No question, no doubt. But the reason why British attempts to subjugate the colonies broke in the end was because of French naval power, French armaments, French troops and training. The French, a monarchical state made up of a Catholic empire, came to the rescue of the Americans and, you know, suffered their own crazy revolution about 20 years later, but that's a slightly different story. The point is, this idea that spontaneous order will save the day all the time just doesn't hold up in real life. It doesn't work. The second major problem with the libertarian ethos is that it completely denies the role of race and IQ. If you look at the libertarian world, you know, this idea that we will all get along, we'll all hold hands, we'll all sing kumbaya together, and everything will be fine, is not true. The libertarian world view requires people who are highly intelligent and highly dedicated to an ideal. And they all have to abide by that ideal. They all have to abide by the principle that we're not going to interfere with each other's lives. We're not going to tell each other how to live. Which means that any differences in any and all differences in lifestyle are tolerated. And this is linked to the next point, which is about moral order. Or the previous point about moral order. As I mentioned previously, there is no concept of fixed morality. If you like and prefer being a Christian, or if you like and prefer being a Muslim, or you like and prefer being a Jew, or an atheist, or a Sikh, or a Hindu, or a Jain, or whatever, that's all fine. You can live and let live. You can be harmonious with each other because you're all living according to the principle that, you know, you do your thing, I have no right to tell you how to live. Well, sorry, but that has never worked in human society. Human societies all come down to individuals who agree to live by a compact, a code, an ethic that says, we believe in these things. If you have a group of diverse individuals who all, of course, must follow at some level a bell curve distribution of intelligence, this by definition will not apply. This meaning this idea that you can just have everybody living differently. This is not going to happen. Human societies over and above the size of a very small village will always have disagreements, differences of opinion, violent clashes, and problems with outsiders. But under a libertarian ethic, it doesn't matter where anybody is from. It doesn't matter if he's black, white, green, yellow, red, blue, pink with purple polka dots. It doesn't matter. As long as he comes in and agrees to live by the non-aggression principle and agrees to obey or honor his contract, he's welcome. Doesn't matter if he practices animal sacrifice in his backyard. Doesn't matter if he believes that his God is better than yours. All that matters is that he agrees to live according to this rule. Okay, again, what if he doesn't agree to live by that rule? Then you've got a problem. And let's say he isn't smart enough to understand this principle. Now what do you do with him? Let's say he comes from a culture and a creed which doesn't accept this problem, this proposition. Now what do you do? Everything about libertarianism is constructed in a vacuum. It's almost like a lab experiment of a society or a philosophy. That brings us to the next problem with libertarianism, which is that it has almost no practical application. Everywhere you look at libertarian ideas and ethics and philosophies and beliefs, they have never ever taken place in a vacuum, ever. The places where libertarian thinking and approaches have applied are always places where there are existing social pressures, historical pressures, religious, political pressures that, to a greater or lesser degree, emphasize the need for personal freedom. If you look at the examples that libertarians like to give, if you read the Mises Institute, for instance, they bring this up, or they used to bring it up a lot, about how spontaneous order would arise in Japanese prisons. Well, yeah, in a prison society, in an already highly oppressive system, where spontaneous order evolved under pressure. If you look at the American experience, where libertarianism came to be kind of one of the defining parts of the American experience, how did that happen? Because groups of like-minded people with like backgrounds, similar religions, similar tastes, similar beliefs, similar IQs, went forth and settled a vast expanse of land. I mean, they literally had to forge a country out of the wilderness with their bare hands. In so doing, they had to make up the rules as they went along. They had to face tremendous natural pressures to survive. These ideas didn't just spring out of nowhere. And if you look at, you know, the very origins of America as a nation, the very first American colonies were not libertarian in nature. They were actually proto-communist. The Jamestown colony was essentially a massive experiment in socialism that went completely wrong. I mean, of course it did. But because it went so wrong, knowingly or unknowingly, pretty much unknowingly actually, the governor of Jamestown came along and said, okay, enough of this collectivist shit. This is nonsense. We're going to give every man a plot of land that he can do with as he pleases. And guess what? The next year, the colony had a bumper harvest. Why? Because people were free to do with their property and their possessions what they wanted to do. But this is not in and of itself a libertarian idea. The idea of private property is not itself libertarian. The idea of private property is rooted much more deeply than that in traditions that are much older than libertarian thought. This combination of factors, this issue of no moral foundation, the issue of complete blindness to race and IQ realities, and the issue of essentially no applicability in real life, leads us to the fourth and biggest problem with libertarianism. It's totally incompatible with the idea of nations. Now, what is a nation? A nation is a group of people bound together by common bonds. The root word for nation is natio. The noun in Latin means essentially, or is related to, birth. So a nation, by definition, includes people who are of the same blood. And those factors are, number one, race, or if you prefer a less loaded term, ethnicity. Number two, religion, or again, less loaded, faith. Number three, territory. You must have actual space to call your own. This is something that civic nationalists always get confused by. They confuse the land with the people. It's not. The most important is always ethnicity. You must have common members of a common tribe, common group, common unit. But they also need someplace to live. So you need land on which they can live. That you need a geographical defined space. Number four, culture, which is to say shared experiences, shared history, shared systems of government that they've all agreed upon, shared values. And number five, language, because you need a way for members of the same community to communicate with each other, to commune, if you will. Now, if you look throughout history at nations of various kinds, some of them have been more complex than others in at least one of these axes. I mean, if you look at India, India is a country with a clearly defined geographical landmass, but you know that definition shifted over time. After 1947, it's been more or less fixed. But before that, you know, depending on which empire you were talking about, the land mass that was India was redefined over time. The Indian people are extremely diverse. They have an extreme diversity of languages. There are like 14, 15, something like that, different official languages in India. Official languages. We're not even talking about the dialects and the regional and state level languages, which number well into the hundreds. If you look at Indonesia, geographically extremely diverse. It's not even known exactly how many Indonesian islands there are. They keep coming up with new ones every, you know, few years. Last time I checked, there was something like in excess of 17,000 individual islands, most of which just have a tree on them, you know. That's it. They're just a rock in the ocean with a tree, and that's part of Indonesia. But the geographical diversity is matched by its population diversity. Somebody from Java is radically different from somebody from Kalimantan or Sulawesi. The western half of the island of Papua New Guinea, whatever island Papua New Guinea is on, that bit. I've forgotten completely. But anyway, the point is that Indonesia is a very varied place. I mean, its geographical qualities have changed. When Timor-Leste, or East Timor, broke away from Indonesia and became a Christian nation of its own, you know, that was quite an event. But the point is that these five axes have held true throughout time. And every nation, whether it's the Jewish nation, which for 2,000 years didn't have a territory of its own, but was still a nation, or what used to be the American nation, which, you know, now has a very clearly defined geographical territory, but is no longer a nation. All of these countries, all of these populations, these communities have had these five things in common at one point or another. There's always been these commonalities. The problem with libertarianism is that it denies the existence of these commonalities. There is one school of libertarian thought, and it is a pretty influential one, which essentially says that there should be no such thing as borders between nations, that, you know, people should be free to come and go through nations as they please, that you should be able to move from one nation to the next, from one place to the next, because any physical or national border, by definition, is an act of aggression against somebody else. So, essentially what they're saying is, you can't have nations. Which is ridiculous, because the nation is the primary organizational unit of any society. You can't have a world without nations, because people have a very clear, observable desire to mix with those who are most like them. That's a fact. and not all of the hand-waving and theoretical musing in the world will change this fact. So, in this respect, libertarianism is completely at odds with human nature. Now, there are other schools of libertarianism which say, well, okay, I mean, you can have nations. You know, nations are a good thing. You know, we need national boundaries, so we need some level of interference and some level of exclusion defining us versus them. But we should also have free trade, because free trade allows people to maximize their economic advantages and economic well-being, and is unquestionably good for both parties involved. Oh, really? In the first place, as Vox Day has very capably demonstrated in his debate with Dr. James Miller, I believe, University of Chicago economist, very, very smart guy himself, Vox Day completely destroyed the argument about free trade by pointing out that free trade, I mean, he pointed out many things, but one of the things he pointed out was that free trade also, by definition, means free labor mobility. So, again, free trade is not compatible with the idea of a nation. You can't have a nation and completely free trade. You can only have a nation with some amount of regulated trade, which, again, is not compatible with libertarian thinking. So either the thinking has to change or the nation has to go away. Which one do you think is going to be easier? Yeah, that's what I thought. The basic problem with libertarianism always comes down to this. It's unworkable. It doesn't make sense. You cannot have a functioning society in a vacuum. You cannot build a functioning, coherent society without some amount of government interference in your life. And that's before we get to the really colossal problem with libertarianism, which is its total lack of a moral foundation. The reason why, as I highlighted earlier, so many young kids get into libertarianism is because they think, ooh, wow, this is great. We have this intellectual justification now for essentially living as we please, for doing what we want. If we want to watch pornography, we can watch pornography. If we want to have unprotected sex with as many people as we want, we can do that. If we want to live life as gays, lesbians, transgenders, queers, intersexuals, questionings, whatever, you know, all those stupid letters in that shit sandwich of an acronym, which is exactly how I think of it. The LGBTQ, what the fuck, WTF is this movement, you know? That's exactly how I think of it, because of the damage it's done to society. That's okay. It's okay to live your life exactly as you want, as long as you're not hurting anyone else. Because, yeah, you know, if you're gay and you're living quietly, that doesn't hurt anyone else, right? Oh, really? Okay. What about the fact that gay men, especially injectable drug-using men, gay men, are extremely effective and extremely dangerous vectors for sexually transmitted diseases? Why is it that AIDS was initially basically a gay men virus? It was spread among gay men. Why is that the case? Because remember that they were living in a very libertine, not libertarian, but libertine environment in San Francisco and in New York in the 1970s, late 60s, you know, 70s thereabouts, where it was very easy for them to have multiple sexual partners and infect each other with what was originally known as GRID, gay-related immunodeficiency disease, or something like that. AIDS was originally known as GRID, and it was known as that precisely because it was a gay disease. What happens when that aspect of the gay lifestyle is introduced into a libertarian community? Then you're going to have massive problems, because you're not going to have the ability to effectively quarantine people, because there is no effective central government. There is no effective use of overweening overarching force that must be respected. Because, again, in the most extreme examples of libertarian thinking, which is either the anarcho-capitalist or minarchist versions of the philosophy, there is no real central government. It's all individuals acting in spontaneous order in mutual agreement with each other to do what best serves their communities. But under a libertarian approach, you can't have a community, because the very ethos of libertarianism undermines the foundational basis for communities. You can't have the two being compatible. They're not compatible. Logically, philosophically, morally, they're not compatible. So you need a system of morality in place to make libertarianism work. The only system of morality that's even close to compatible with libertarian ethic is Christianity. But Christianity imposes certain strictures which libertarians don't like. It imposes strictures on who you can and cannot worship. It imposes strictures on sexual morality, which is a big one. And it imposes strictures on your lifestyle, which, again, people who follow a libertarian ethic don't want. They don't like it. This is one thing you find in common with libertarians all the time. They're essentially looking for a philosophical and intellectual excuse to move past their own lack of standards. They're looking for a justification for their bad behavior. Now, I'm not saying, please don't misunderstand me, I'm not saying that all libertarians are degenerate freaks. That's patently not true. There are plenty of libertarians out there who follow a vastly superior, or live a much superior moral life to me and to most other Christians. They are genuine, decent, kind, caring, wonderful, lovely people. I mean that in all sincerity. These are really good, profoundly good people, much, much better people than I am. But they still believe in a completely nonsensical philosophy, one that has no foundation in anything. It's a rootless, groundless philosophy. The reality of libertarianism, which is something that libertarians don't like to hear, but it's the truth, is that libertarianism is a consequence, not a cause, of a just, moral, well-built, rational society. And the lessons of history teach us that just, moral, well-built, rational societies come from cultures that exhibit very clear pathologies or traits, if you want a less pejorative term. Most important among these traits is sexual fidelity, monogamy or chastity, well, strictly enforced chastity before marriage on both parts, for both men and women, chastity before marriage and monogamy after marriage. Strict monogamy after marriage. Why is that? Well, there's a lot of theories about it. I mean, if you want to read the works of J.D. Unwin, he wrote a 600-plus page book on the subject. Mary Eberstadt did some great research into why it is that societies with broken family systems fall apart very quickly, and why mass murder in particular becomes very common in these societies. It's beyond my ken to speculate on that for the time being. But the reality is that a society where people are free to live as they please and do as they want is actually a society founded on very clear moral values. Because in order to be free to do as you please and live as you want, everyone else has to obey the same moral code. And you have to live in a world in which you have the flexibility to do that. You don't have to worry about obeying a bunch of stupid rituals and following an irrational code, because all of the groundwork that is required for you to live peacefully and quietly with your neighbors has already been laid. You already have a functional nation. You already have a minimally oppressive system of government that everybody agrees on, everybody likes. You already have, most importantly, a moral foundation that everybody builds upon, everybody takes as given. The societies where this has worked most plainly are of two strains, mostly. Number one, Number one is Western European Christian societies, so which is to say, Western nations. And number two, Asian societies. And this might sound strange because of the rigidly hierarchical nature of, in particular, Chinese or Confucian society. But actually, if you look at the teachings of Lao Tzu and earlier Chinese philosophers, you'll find that they were remarkably enlightened on the subject of individual free will and the rights of people to live in peace and harmony as long as they did so with respect to their elders. But again, in both cases, the idea of living as you please came from a society rooted in something important already. The necessary systems and ideas or systems and principles needed to allow for freedom already existed, so that the people in those societies didn't have to sit there and worry about how to obey or please their king. They didn't have to sit there and worry about bribing their local government official. They didn't have to sit there and worry about how am I going, you know, who's going to defend me from this invading army. All of this stuff was already there. It was prepackaged. These things found their highest expressions in the Western nations every time. The settlers who came over from Europe to the USA were fleeing oppression in their home countries, but they came to the USA and they were faced with massive societal pressures to create communities of their own. And what did they create? They created things that were remarkably similar to what they left behind, with some important changes. So the original colonies, for instance, adopted a constitutional framework that was actually based on the English system of common law and parliamentary rule. But instead of having a king who could rule them for life and whose powers were unchecked by parliament, they created a temporary king who could only rule over them for a certain amount of time, and a relatively strong Congress, and significantly greater divisions between the will of the people and the will of the states, so that everything was kind of put into balance with each other. And then when the colonists began to expand out into the Western frontier, they were basically moving away from the reach of government and into their own more spontaneously ordered systems. But what did they take with them? An appreciation for the need for authority, which is why the local sheriff was one of their own. He was part of their nation, their community. The local town council was elected from within themselves, a reflection of what already existed back east in the big cities and in the original colonies. Time and time and time again, what you find with libertarian societies that keep being upheld as these paragons of how this could work in real life are basically just stripped down copies of what already existed before with some modifications. In no such situation has there arisen spontaneously in a vacuum a libertarian society that just worked out of the box. It doesn't happen. So, in conclusion, libertarianism is really libertunianism. It's a cartoon philosophy. Doesn't work in real life, doesn't have any application. If you look at its roots, it's intellectually bankrupt. Doesn't make sense. Its foundations are unsupported by the evidence. Its ability to survive as a proper system of government is not possible. All you have to do to look at the failures of a libertarian ethic are the ways in which, as the Supreme Dark Lord referenced just today in his post, the way in which internet discussion forums and media sites have completely devolved. Because rather than being self-enforcing and self-perpetuating, these forums have become just inundated with trolls who abuse their privileges and completely drive out the rational and sane commenters who just want to have a good time, just want to do some bants with their friends, just want to engage in some good discourse, some intellectual sparring, whatever. The trolls have ruined it completely. You know, my blog is relatively immune from this simply because it's tiny. But if you look at Vox Day's blog and the sheer amount of the troll attacks that it gets every day, now that it gets like 100,000 page views every single day, it's insane how much moderation has to go on just to keep that place sensible and reasonably free. It's not possible to have man obeying his own instincts without some sort of authority above him to enforce them. When you give man complete license to live as he pleases, he inevitably cocks it up. Without some overarching authority to tell him, hey, knock it off, pal, you're being a dick, you need to stop making such a nuisance of yourself, or else there will be consequences. If you don't have that, your society is going to fail. And that's exactly what we've seen on the internet, and that's exactly what we'll always see with libertarian societies. So, I've gone on for quite long enough. It is quite late where I am, and I am rather tired, so I shall leave off here. Once again, I am Didact. This has been Didactic Mind, Episode 8. The Lie of Libertunianism. As always, subscribe if you have not already. Please feel free to like and comment here on SoundCloud or at my blog. And all relevant links will be left in the description box. And I will see you in the new year for another podcast. Thank you, take care, and see you then.